Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, the big news this week, the FDA granted full approval of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for anyone age 16 and older. Children 12 years and older are still able to get the vaccine under the FDA's emergency use authorization. This full approval comes about 9 months since the FDA granted emergency approval of the vaccine. Now, that was back in December of 2020. The emergency approval also extends as a booster shot. Joining us now to help us understand the approval process is Dr. Donald J. Alcindor with Meharry Medical College in Nashville, which is the first medical school for African Americans established in the South. Welcome to Insight, Dr. Alcindor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You have a background with the FDA, correct?
That's correct.
And can you explain what your background is?
Well, I spent time on the FDA Antiviral Advisory Board Committee. And so as a committee, we meet and we talk about clinical information that's been developed from drugs that are going to be used as antivirals to treat people. These are experimental drugs that are looking for approval from the FDA. Mm-hmm. And so before that, a drug has to go through the FDA Antiviral Advisory Board Committee. And of course, that committee then makes a recommendation to the FDA.
Yeah, with that experience, what are the biggest differences between an emergency use authorization and a full FDA approval?
So I think what people have to understand, what is emergency use to start with? So emergency use authorization is approval that's only given when there's no adequate approved or available alternative. And it's clear that COVID-19 met that criteria in terms of nobody had anything that would work on this virus infection. And so the strategy was then to develop a vaccine, but not by traditional means. So when you think about a vaccine in the United States, it takes about 12 years to develop from an experimental drug that would go from the laboratory into the arms of people. And so what they did is that they got emergency use authorization by a very ingenious plan. And the idea was to take what was known, all of the volunteers that they had ready to go through these trials, and all of the experience they had. And then on top of that, they did something very interesting. They went and took an mRNA vaccine that has never spent any time to a large extent in humans as a treatment and developed that vaccine in a very short amount of time. And again, the way this was done is that the different phases of the clinical trials were overlapped. They had prior information from the Chinese in terms of the target antigen that would be used in the vaccine. It turns out Pfizer and Moderna, they had experience with mRNA vaccines in the past. This experience goes back 2 decades. And so everything was there for them to produce a vaccine very quickly. Now, would it work in humans? That was the issue. And it turns out they got the green light. The phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials were very good, approved by the FDA. They got emergency use authorization. And again, emergency use authorization requires 2 months of data from the vaccines. And that is to make sure that within 2 months, usually, any type of ill effects from the vaccine would present itself. To get full approval, you need 6 months of cumulative data on the vaccines to get full approval. And so that data is collected. And of course, the FDA will review this and then issue a BLA. And a BLA is a biologic licensing application. And of course, once that is issued, the vaccine in this case was given full approval on August 23rd, which was yesterday.
Hmm. So kind of breaking all of that down, and given that trials and studies were being done concurrently for emergency use authorization and full approval, yeah. Is there any difference in the vaccine from when it was first authorized? And we're talking about Pfizer here for emergency use in December compared to now?
No, that's not expected. And of course, if there was any changes in the formulation of the vaccine, the FDA would make recommendations for or against that. And so they would have to go through a very ordered process to make changes in their formulation of the vaccine. And, of course, that would have to be approved by the FDA as well, because you have to realize the original vaccine that went into the volunteers that were part of the phase studies has to be the vaccine down the road, you see, without any kind of changes. And so you don't expect a company to make changes to their vaccine. If there are problems, then the vaccine is then given some type of warnings that are issued by the FDA. And that is the case for some of the vaccines. There is expected to be some side effects. And, of course, these side effects are limited. And again, if they are significant, then the FDA will include a warning on the labeling for that particular product.
Why did Pfizer cross this threshold before the other two vaccines that currently have emergency use authorization in the United States?
I think you want to think about it as size and experience. Moderna was a very small company that had never put out an FDA-approved drug ever until, and still until now, they have not. They have emergency use authorization, but they have never had a fully approved drug of any sort. Pfizer has big shoulders. This is a company that is very experienced. And then they tag team with a global partner that is BioNTech, which is a German powerhouse company that had a lot of experience in developing mRNA vaccine and immunological assays and immunological therapeutics. And so when you put them together, you had a tremendous company that could push things forward relatively easy. Many of the companies started at the same level because the Trump administration provided $10 billion to make this happen. And the mission of Operation Warp Speed was to deliver a safe and effective vaccine that is 300 million doses by January 1st, 2021. And it turns out both Pfizer and Moderna delivered on that mission. They didn't produce the 300 million doses, but they delivered what we now know as a safe and effective vaccine as an intervention for COVID-19.
Do you anticipate that Moderna and Johnson & Johnson will also receive full approval in the coming months, maybe this year, by the FDA?
That's expected. So Moderna is currently seeking full FDA approval for its COVID-19 vaccine as well. It applied for full approval in May, which is about a month after Pfizer. So its approval is expected in a few weeks. And now, in contrast to Johnson & Johnson, several months behind Pfizer and Moderna.
You know, given the reality that there's a sizable group of people in this country and in this state that are hesitant to get vaccinated or don't want to get vaccinated, are you concerned about, what are your concerns about the full approval process by the FDA? Do you think that's going to contribute to misinformation? Or on the flip side, do you think it's going to quell the concerns of individuals who are on the fence?
So more than a half of the unvaccinated people that were unsure of FDA status and approval, they won't have issues anymore with full approval. About a third of individuals say that the reasons why they're not accepting of the vaccine is because the vaccine still appears to them as experimental because it was not fully approved. That's taken off the table now. The other issues is that companies, employers that are looking at mandating vaccinations across the board now are going to be looking at this full approval as a green light to them going through, saying that this vaccine now is fully approved, effective and safe, and so forth. And of course, the vaccine companies now can basically provide this drug to the public. And of course, under emergency use authorization, you didn't have to pay for this vaccine. With licensure, with full approval, now the companies get the opportunity to charge for this vaccine, and you may be looking at paying for this vaccine very soon after full approval.
Right, and make a profit. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Donald Alcindor about the FDA's full approval of the Pfizer vaccine. You know, one of the biggest arguments or underlying arguments that's been made since the beginning was is that this happened too quickly for some individuals. Given your background with the FDA and your understanding of the approval process, Can you explain the process of what led to this moment for the Pfizer vaccine?
So if we start at the beginning, first of all, traditional timelines for vaccine, 10 to 15 years, average 12 years. Vaccines have to go through an exploratory phase where you find out exactly what antigen is going to be incorporated into the vaccine formulation. Then there's the preclinical stage. Now, this will be in mice, in animal models of some sort. And then the company submits what is called an IND, or Investigational New Drug Application. That application now then goes under review by the FDA, and if approved, the company now can start their phase one studies. And now here in the phase one and phase two studies, they're looking for, is this vaccine is safe, and what kind of immune response you get after taking it in terms of protecting you in cell culture assays from that infection. And then there is the big phase three trial where you have a multitude of individuals. For Pfizer, you're talking about 43,000 people. For Moderna, 30,400 people participated as volunteers. And again, in the phase three, you have half of them getting the placebo, half of them getting the vaccine in the vaccine arm. And then they're asked to go out there and do their normal business. And they are then monitored for looking at who becomes infected and who does not. And from that, they're able to develop efficacy for the vaccine. And of course, after phase three studies are approved, and again, they have to go through the Data Safety Monitoring Board that looks at all clinical data and all the results, including the adverse events and side effects from the vaccines over time in the volunteers. And then, of course, after that, it's the BLA is submitted. And the BLA is the Biologics License Application. Now, once you get here and get the green light, then you get full approval by the FDA at that point. Before that, you would get emergency use authorization. Of course, after the BLA is signed off by the FDA, you have full approval. And for Pfizer, that happened yesterday. And of course, what they have done through their way of not shortcuts, but using strategy to do this quicker, they basically started manufacturing at the same time phase one studies were established, meaning that they were way ahead of the game. And I think at the end of the road, in terms of Pfizer and Moderna, you're looking at just the big shoulders of Pfizer and the professionalism of BioNTech being able to push this through first. And so they got EUA first on December 11th. Moderna came December 18th. But again, they were able to push this forward. And again, when you think about it, they're basically a week behind each other, week or two behind each other, in terms of emergency use and not full approval.
With that, when do you expect, or do you expect that this will streamline the vaccine, maybe at this point just Pfizer, to be approved for children under 12?
Well, it's clear that the studies, the clinical trials for that are in place now. More than likely, you will probably hear from that, I would say, the beginning of next year. And of course, this is something that's very important, because when we look at it, we still have about 85 million people that are unvaccinated. And of course, some of these folks are very hesitant, and we're hoping that the full approval of the Pfizer vaccine will bring some of them on the right side of the fence, in my mind, in terms of getting this vaccine. So I think getting children vaccinated is going to be important. However, dosing and how it's going to be done has to be looked at. And, of course, this will be scrutinized very severely, in a sense where you're looking at dosing an 11-year-old versus a two-month-old. And so there's a lot of information that's needed for you to do that right. And, of course, adverse events in pediatric populations are going to be very important, and that has to be monitored before the FDA would give the green light on that.
Can you explain and shed a little bit more light on the group of 12 between 16 that don't have the full approval for Pfizer but are still under emergency use authorization? Why is that?
Yeah, I think when you go below 12, there's a general concern. So when you look at a person 12 to 15, they feel in terms of their immune response and their recognition of antigens that produce an immune response, it would be very similar. And I think what they feel is that after that, the 11 and going, say, 11 to 5 or 11 to 6, that's one thing to consider. But then when you go and you start to look at 5 to 2 months, this is going to be very different in terms of how they are. And again, you're looking also at young people, adolescents, going through changes in their life, puberty at the time, and so forth. And this is something of a concern. And they just want to be right about this. Because to make this very difficult is all you have to do is see adverse events in young people and parents would pull away, and that would be a problem. And so they want to do this right. They want to be careful, and they want to be vigilant in being able to vaccinate these young people and allow them to go to school without a mask in the future.
Dr. Alcindor, thank you so much for spending time with us and just helping break down, you know, what is really a complicated process.
Yes.
Dr. Donald J. Alcindor is with Meharry Medical College in Nashville. Up next, we'll explore the legality of employers mandating vaccinations for its workforce. And a maternal health physician breaks down the CDC's new vaccine recommendation for pregnant and nursing mothers. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, in line with the FDA's full approval of the Pfizer vaccine, more and more employers are mandating employees get vaccinated. The Pentagon made that announcement for active duty members yesterday. Cities like Sacramento are requiring vaccinations for city staff, not to mention California state workers and healthcare workers. And that's just naming a few. But legally, can employees challenge the mandates and take their employer to court? Jennifer Shaw is a lawyer focused on employment law. Coincidentally, she's actually holding a webinar on this very topic as I speak. Because of that, I was able to sit down with her about an hour ago before her webinar started, and she shares her expertise on the legal gray areas. All right, Jennifer, you're an expert in employment law. I would imagine your phone and your inboxes have been pretty busy lately.
Yes, there is a lot going on, Vicki, for sure.
The big question that's being debated is whether vaccines should be mandated. Do employers have legal footing to do so?
Absolutely. And this has been the case since the very beginning. Although, of course, there are different perspectives and different viewpoints. Legally, the law is clear, both federal and state, that employers can mandate these vaccination programs, subject, of course, to providing a reasonable accommodation to individuals who have a disability or medical condition that will prevent them from being vaccinated.
I think that's going to come to a surprise for some people. Why do they have the legal footing to mandate vaccinations?
Well, here's the thing that a lot of us, I think, have sort of forgotten about. The pandemic is unprecedented. So we just haven't seen something like this happen in over a century. So although employers don't necessarily have the right to impose something like a flu shot, because the threat to employee health and safety is less with the flu, with the standard flu, than with COVID, employers have a lot more rights with COVID because of the public safety component. Now, I recognize not everybody agrees with that, that the flu, for example, is not as lethal as COVID. But that's what the enforcement agencies have looked at, is that we're really in this health and safety universe where the employers have to have the ability to mandate vaccinations if they want to.
You know, what kind of calls and questions have you been getting?
Well, it's funny. We have been incredibly busy, of course, since the pandemic, you know, joined us over a year ago. And we have various issues that come up on the mandated vaccination. I think the trickiest part is religious exemptions, because, of course, we all know there has been a lot out there in social media about being able to purchase an exemption. There are churches that have granted sort of what they consider to be a mass exemption. So I have employers calling saying, wait a minute, what is a sincerely held religious belief? What are we looking at? How far can we push? And again, I think a lot of employees and applicants are going to be surprised, because even though somebody can have an anecdotal belief, right? So for example, I don't have to believe, I might be Catholic, but I don't have to believe everything that the Pope says, right? I can have my own belief system. My belief has to preclude me from getting vaccinated. And that's the part that's really confusing people, because a lot of the requests for exemption that are coming into our clients say things like, my religion says I have to exercise my conscience, and my conscience says I shouldn't be vaccinated because I don't believe it's safe, and I don't believe that the government can force me to do this. None of that has anything to do with the religious belief. Literally, the religious belief has to say you can't get vaccinated. Now, it's not going to say you can't get vaccinated against COVID-19 because this is new, right? But there has to be something there saying you can't get preventive medical treatment. You have to be in a situation where you can show what's called the conflict, right? The conflict between what the employer wants to make you do or not allow you to do and your religious belief. We have looked at this very broadly, I think, as a community since COVID came. And so what's happened is people have a very loose definition of what that connection, what that conflict is. And most of them are not putting forth the facts to actually substantiate their entitlement to an exemption.
So is that why, you know, on the front end, there were some employers that were asking employees to get vaccinated or regularly test for COVID, you know, once or twice a week or whatever. But some employers have pulled back from that, and now they're mandating vaccinations. So I guess what I'm gathering from you is legally they can do that.
Legally they can do it. And I think certainly with respect to the clients who we're working with, most of them are saying, look, I thought testing was as good as mandating a vaccination. Now that the CDC has come out and we have all this evidence that says, look, the vaccinations are the strongest weapon we have. Testing is great, but people could have been exposed while you're waiting for the test results. You know, you're not going to test continuously when somebody's at work, obviously. So I think what's happened is, as our knowledge has improved about the virus, about how we prevent it, how it is spread, et cetera, a lot of employers are saying, look, we can't safely operate our business. We can't avoid lawsuits for not having appropriate workplace safety if we don't require the vaccinations.
So even despite there being a legal footing to mandate vaccinations and to not offer an option A or option B when it comes to getting vaccinated or getting tested, I imagine there's still going to be some pushback and legal pushback. Do you envision lawsuits as a result of this?
Absolutely, Vicki. No doubt about it. Because think about it this way. When you're talking about a medical exemption or a religious exemption, they're all fact specific, right? It's all going to depend on what the employee said, what process the employer has in place. So I do think that there'll be litigation. The other thing to really understand from a practical perspective is that we're in a labor shortage. Most of my clients can't find people to work for them. So there's also a balance that employers have to look at in terms of, okay, maybe I can mandate vaccinations, but if I'm going to lose half of my labor force, it's probably not worth it. So what else can I do? And what we're seeing is there are a group of employers who are saying, all right, I'm not going to mandate vaccinations. I'm going to mandate biweekly testing. I'm also going to give everybody respirators to wear. If they're not vaccinated, okay, they're going to have the choice to be vaccinated. But if they're not, I'm going to get them those N95 NIOSH approved respirators. It's not actually an electronic respirator, of course. They just call it a respirator. It's the very tightly fitting mask that has multiple layers of protection. Those are really safe, and a lot of healthcare providers and employers are doing that. So when you can't afford to lose your employees, Another option is to say, all right, if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a respirator, you don't have to get tested. But if you're not vaccinated, I'm going to do all of that. Still up to you. Now, here's the really interesting thing, Vicki. What if somebody says, my religion prevents me from being vaccinated and my religion prevents me from being tested? Well, at that point, there aren't a lot of accommodations that the employer can provide if we assume the employee needs to be working on site, on location. Obviously, if you have a 100% remote workplace, you don't care if they get vaccinated, right? They're not going to be interacting with anybody. But if you have people coming on site who say, I can't get vaccinated and I can't get testing, there's not a lot you can do for those individuals.
Hmm. You know, the recall election is exactly 3 weeks from today. You know, if the state moves in another direction, and hypothetically, if Governor Newsom is recalled, the Republican candidates who have participated in debates so far have indicated that they would pull back on state mandates. I'm just curious, can a governor legally do so, obviously through an executive order, when it comes to impacting local governments, school districts, and even private companies?
Yes, the governor has a lot of leeway in terms of implementing executive orders, just like the president does, right? So we've seen just in the transition to President Biden this year, we've seen executive orders that President Trump put in place have been revoked, and we've seen President Biden put new ones in place. Now, we could have a very interesting, I think, constitutional discussion about how far that power actually goes. How far can a governor, an executive, actually go in making law, making rules? But certainly with respect to safety issues, once there's a declaration of emergency, a state of emergency, as there has been since COVID started, we're in a situation where they have a lot of leeway. So if we get a governor from the Republican Party, things may change. Now, what is interesting is there are laws on the books that the legislature would have to change. So, for example, we have reporting requirements if somebody is COVID-19 positive. There are workers' compensation protections. There's CalOSHA's emergency temporary standards that are not implemented by the governor. Those are implemented by the agency pursuant to a formal rulemaking process. So some of these rules are not going to be as easily disposed of as issuing the new executive order. Hmm.
Finally, I'm just curious the conversations that you're having when it comes to employees who are uncomfortable with an employer mandating a vaccine or be terminated. What do you tell them?
Well, here's the thing. I have a lot of empathy for everybody in this situation. Certainly from the employer's perspective, they have very rigid health and safety requirements they have to meet. They also frequently care about their employees and they want to make sure they're healthy. On the other hand, I understand the arguments that people are having about their freedoms and their independence. But to me, what I try to explain is, look, there are rules we all have to follow. Things like, wearing a seatbelt, not drinking while driving. I mean, there are things out there that we all are subject to. And I think the problem with the term mandatory vaccination is nobody's going around and grabbing people and making them get vaccinated. There is if you want to work, or if you want to go to a restaurant in Los Angeles or San Francisco, or if you want to ride on an airplane, there are certain things you have to do. So I think it's important for people to really look at these vaccination requirements through a lens of sort of goodwill and understanding what's going on. I don't advocate that people are fired if they can't be vaccinated. If there's any way for the employer to accommodate that individual, whether it's through testing or through putting them in some other area of the workplace, whatever they can do, I think that's the right thing to do. You worked hard to get the person in the door. You need the skills that the person has. Let's figure out what we can do. But there is a point where when somebody says, I won't get vaccinated, I don't believe in COVID-19, I'm not getting tested, that's fine, but you may not be able to come to work. You may not be able to shop. You may not be able to go to a restaurant because we're in a public health crisis and the rules apply a lot differently in these kinds of circumstances.
And that was my conversation with Jennifer Shaw, a lawyer focused on employment law, discussing the legalities of employers mandating COVID vaccines for employees. Our conversation was recorded about an hour ago. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is strongly recommending that pregnant and breastfeeding women get vaccinated against COVID-19. Initially, the CDC had encouraged pregnant women to consider getting vaccinated. This is now a full recommendation and extends to nursing mothers and women trying to get pregnant. So far, fewer than 1 in 4 pregnant women in the country have received their first dose of a COVID vaccine, and physicians have reported more infections among pregnant patients in recent weeks. Here to explain what led to the new recommendation is Dr. Veronique Taché, a maternal fetal medicine physician at UC Davis Health. She joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Dr. Taché, before we dive into the data, is UC Davis seeing an increase in cases among pregnant women?
Yes, we are. We are seeing on our service more patients who have been unvaccinated getting sick with COVID infection. And the concerning aspect of that is there are more risk for severe COVID-19 infection, including ICU admissions and ventilator use. And then that in turn can affect the baby's outcome in terms of having to undergo preterm delivery just to help care for the mother.
Well, given that the CDC has new research leading to strengthening their recommendation going from encouragement to a full recommendation for not only pregnant women, but breastfeeding women and also women who want to get pregnant to get vaccinated, what exactly changed this month?
So there was a study that came out during the month of it was a voluntary smartphone-based surveillance system where pregnant women who had either been prior to conceiving or during pregnancy responded to the study by stating whether or not they had risks mainly related to miscarriages. Now, the background risk for a miscarriage is 10 to 20%, although that is dependent on the mom's age. So the older you are, the higher the risk of miscarriage. And so with that background risk, they wanted to see, well, what was the miscarriage risk in women who've gotten the COVID vaccination? And they essentially found that that risk was about 13% for miscarriage. So from that data, they were able to say that certainly the vaccine wasn't going to cause an increased risk of miscarriage if women chose to get the vaccination.
Please continue. And then I do have a follow-up.
So that led them to say, look, it's not increasing the miscarriage risk. We know that this disease is devastating for pregnant moms. Based on this, information we have, we really think that this is a vaccination we can be recommending to pregnant women.
So essentially, when you're saying that there's no increased risk for pregnant women who were vaccinated with against COVID-19, it's because the risk of miscarriage was consistent or fell within the lines of just the average risk just for pregnant women overall.
Correct.
Got it. When discussing COVID vaccines with expecting mothers or with patients who are trying to get pregnant, what questions do they have and how do you navigate their concern?
Yes. So I think the big concern they have is prior to last week was it's not still FDA approved. So certainly the announcement yesterday that it's that the Pfizer vaccine is FDA approved hopefully will help push people over to the side of getting it. I think the other concern is how will it affect my baby? And I've also had COVID, so therefore I don't need the vaccination.
There were also cases, I've read some stories, that newborns with vaccinated mothers, they ended up showing antibodies for COVID-19. Are we seeing more solid data behind that?
So I'm not aware of that quite yet, but that would be in line as to what vaccines can do when given in pregnancy. It's the whole reason we strongly recommend getting the pertussis or whooping cough vaccination during pregnancy, is that it can then be transmitted to the baby through antibodies during it when they're breastfeeding.
One of the more common concerns out there is potentially, and I guess I'm just curious, is this a misconception that the vaccine can affect a woman's menstrual cycle?
Yes. So typically I only see pregnant women, so I don't get that one, but I have heard of that one. There's no compelling biological reason why that would happen. So it's hard for me to explain that one because, you know, as much as I'd want to try and explain something rationally, in my mind, I'm not seeing a biological reason why that would happen. But I have heard that one.
You know, as a physician, I mean, you know, you navigate a lot of concerns with your patients. I guess I want to end with, what are the benefits of getting the COVID vaccine for pregnant women? And also, I mean, interesting enough, for breastfeeding women as well.
I think first and foremost, it's protecting the moms. Pregnancy, especially in advanced gestation, does impair lung function at baseline, whether you're sick or not. And then you add on top of that a disease that affects your lungs with an already compromised state. I think that's the reason why we're seeing our pregnant patients get so sick. So I think first and foremost, it's protecting the mom. It's also protecting families and the community. It's really hard for these women to be separated from their families in the hospital, potentially be separated from their newborn. So I think in my mind, it's first and foremost the mom and the baby. Now, as OBGYNs, our mission is really, we want the best outcomes for our patients. And that means both parent and baby. And so if we really had any concerns regarding this, I don't think you'd see us be so behind this vaccination. We really feel like it's in the best interest for moms and their babies to get this vaccination. And certainly if you're thinking about getting pregnant and haven't gotten it, this would be a great time to get it before you get pregnant as well. And when you're breastfeeding as well. So I think this has been really great news for us as OBGYNs because we haven't seen any risks related to the vaccine in our population. And it's nice that nationally all of this is being compiled to essentially agree with what we're seeing.
If a breastfeeding mother gets vaccinated, does that benefit the infant as well?
Correct. So as you alluded to before, the antibodies from the mom's vaccination will certainly help protect the baby against COVID as well.
Dr. Tesche, thanks for helping explain all of that for us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Dr. Veronique Tesche is a maternal fetal medicine physician at UC Davis Health. Still ahead, the B Street Theater joins us with a preview of their full reopening, more than a year after production was largely curtailed due to the pandemic. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Do you remember the last time you went to a play? It's probably been a minute. Although California did reopen on June 15th, it's taken some venues more time than others to ensure everything's in order before welcoming back audiences. While the B Street Theater has been open for a few performances already, they're gearing up to welcome back audiences in full swing next month. Joining us now with a preview is Jerry Montoya. He is the B Street Theater's executive producer. Jerry, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having us here.
This must be a real exciting time after, you know, kind of the drought and creativity we've been having.
Yeah, we've been very busy during the pandemic, doing a lot of virtual shows. But to actually have people in the building again, we actually start rehearsal in 12 minutes for our first show. So we're all very excited.
Wow. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a little emotional, too, just the collective aspect of all of it.
Yeah, it's been surreal, really. It's been an empty building for so long to walk around and actually be having to clean things and, you know, dust things off and running into people now and again. And we both freeze in the hallway and stare at each other like, are you really there? Is this really happening? So,
well, given that the theater is going to finally reopen in September 14th, what's different now with the theater?
Well, we're going through obviously a lot of different protocols for the audience. We're a fully vaxxed workplace and to enter the building, as well as obviously the county mandate about fully masked as well. But the Actors Union has given us a lot of protocols to follow. And people will be, instead of a freewheeling workplace, if you're not required to be in rehearsal, don't go to rehearsal. It's going to be a much, everybody stay away. Don't get the actor sick, because if an actor gets sick, it's much harder to replace an actor than almost anyone. So,
right. So the first performance is Dance Nation, correct?
Dance Nation by Claire Barron.
Yeah, I feel like that name is just so fitting, given that, you know, as I've said, you know, venues have been closed for the, you know, about a year and a half. I think that's a perfect first performance for B Street Theater.
It's going to be, it's really a wild, outrageous comedy. It's a bunch of teenagers played by adults. So it's a lot of grown women channeling their inner 13-year-olds and going back through that again. I don't know if they're going to enjoy going back through being 13 again, but we're going to have fun watching it. So,
how has the theater survived the last 18 months?
Well, three different ways. One, our subscriber base, our patrons have been incredibly generous and incredibly supportive. We've all stuck together and stayed connected with them. We also, you know, the initial PPP loan helped us keep people employed for a while. And then there was the Shuttered Venue Operator Grant. But it's really been our subscribers, people who continued to buy subscriptions or donate subscriptions back to us and just wrote little checks here and there. And it all added up to just staying week to week, keep going and keep going. So that's really been the challenge, is just making payroll every week. It's been the challenge.
You know, given that the state, you know, effectively reopened June 15th, it's been about 2 months. I would imagine that went by, you know, kind of in a blink when you're thinking logistically about getting B Street Theater up and running and welcoming back audiences.
Right. Both with concerts and with plays, it takes months really to plan it. We couldn't just open and have a concert. You know, touring acts are putting together 10 dates and to make it worth their while. We've had three events so far. We actually have your McMartin playing this Saturday. McMartin from Cap Radio is having a blues show. We also have a comedy show this Saturday. And so we're doing sporadic events, which allows us to kind of test our new protocols and train some new employees who really aren't familiar with the entire building and kind of just getting our feet wet. And then because on September 14th, when we open the theater daily, it's going to be a very different animal, and we need to all know exactly what's going on with all the new protocols. So,
I would imagine that there were some learning curves during this process. Was one of the learning curves booking artists and performers differently? I mean, how did you go about that?
Well, we were booking people virtually for a while, and also everyone in the industry understood that the challenge was, when are we reopening? So there was a lot of, we're going to book this date. Everybody's open to moving this date. Everybody's opening to, well, look, not everybody's going to make a ton of money here. Let's just try to make each other survive this. And so there was a really a lot of, like everyone, I think, experienced complete strangers talking to a promoter in Ireland. And then you're having this long conversation about their kids and what they're going through. And so there was a lot of connection and support in this community for each other. And it was really, I think, fantastic.
What personally surprised you during this whole process?
How much I enjoyed working at home.
Yeah. It's nice having the fridge close by and your own personal restroom.
But, you know, to spend all day with my son and my dog was, I don't know if I'd trade that. I mean, I know that we've suffered a lot and a lot of people have suffered. But he's 20 and he's going to leave at some point permanently. And I've had a great year and a half just, you know, spending time with him. And my dog, of course, got tremendously spoiled. And really, I think everybody went through a personal reckoning of what's important to them. And that I fortunately live right by the river, so I had a lot of outdoor time and just slowed down. We can get very, very busy. And we all learn to value human connection in a different way, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I think it all forced us in a good way to reevaluate what's important to us in our lives. And that's just really kind of a beautiful silver lining of what is really just such a difficult 18 months and counting. When it comes to what audiences and attendees need to know, what's the conversation surrounding vaccinations and getting tested for COVID?
What we're asking people and really explaining to them is we're trying to protect patrons. If everyone's vaccinated, everyone can relax a little bit more and enjoy the show. If you're not relaxed, you're not going to have a great time and laugh. And we want people to laugh and celebrate this coming out of, we're not fully out of the pandemic, but you know, while we're vaccinated, we can at least enjoy each other's company a little bit more. We've had, you know, very, very, very little pushback and explaining that it's really not about your individual needs as much as it is about the group. And people went, okay, I get that. There is always going to be exceptions and unique circumstances that we'll work with people on. But for the most part, people have been very supportive and said, I wouldn't be coming here if it wasn't this strict about being vaccinated. We will do tests if people need that. And we have them available at the theater. But for the most part, we've had fully vaccinated people. And show up with your card, show up with the QR code, and come right on in.
So it is a requirement if you want to go to the B Street Theater.
It is currently a requirement to be fully vaccinated for all employees, for the bands, for everyone. Bands are calling us and saying, is this a fully vaccinated place or we can't play there? Some of our bands are older people and like Greg Adams, you know, who've been around for a long time, and they're very concerned about it. They want to know if it's a safe place to come work. So,
will capacity be the same as prior to the pandemic?
Currently, we are at full capacity, which for us is 250 in our playhouse and 360 in our large space. So it's not a huge crowd, but it's a good sized crowd and it's a lot of energy and it feels really good when it's full.
Finally, I can't help but just be reminded of what we just talked about, that you're going to be going into your first rehearsal in just about 10 minutes, which is so exciting. I guess looking ahead to this season, what are you most excited about?
Well, we're going to bring back some shows that I was really excited about that we missed in 2020 that people were excited about. We're not announcing a full season yet because there's some surprises in there. And our subscribers haven't been fully informed of the entire season. But I think there's going to be some real, real exciting stuff that we're doing. It allowed us to really sit back and go, what's our favorite work here? What are we going to do? Let's pick our favorite ones and then find more. And it's going to be all year is going to be a celebration, I think, of live performance. And people will laugh, they'll cry, they'll just have an amazing time, is what we're hoping.
Well, Jerry, I'm excited for you and the entire team at B Street Theater. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having us on. We really appreciate you and your team.
And have a great inaugural rehearsal for your
season.
Thank
you so much.
Jerry Montoya is the executive producer for B Street Theater in Sacramento. Well, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.